Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we will continue in our ever-expanding quest to understand the cultures of consciousness. On this show I've generally tried to not hook into current events, the latest sort of brainworm that's going through the media, if only because it's such an easy and tempting thing to do. There's stuff going on, everyone's thinking, everyone's looking at certain things going on in the world, the storm, the politics, the State of the Union address, and sometimes it's nice just to have a conversation that's talking about something else. But once in a while it becomes impossible to avoid addressing what's going on the world stage, because it's just so interesting and so fascinating. And from the point of view of the topic of the show, of this question of consciousness, of mind, in our hyperlinked, exploding, collapsing, culture-saturated world, that it is a matter of consciousness in a way. How do we react to world events? How do we allow the mediation of these events to shape our minds, to shift us, to let us see in a different way, even though we're stuck perhaps in the routines of our ordinary life? And I'm speaking, of course, of this extraordinary explosion of democratic and aggressively transformative desire in Egypt. And one of the things that I've been reflecting on is how, when this event sort of appeared in my field of awareness, a week ago plus, how I was aware that I didn't really understand what was going on at all. And that usually when some major media event occurs or a process is going on, it takes very little time for us to feel already sort of woven into the story, a story of what's happening, a story of how people are thinking of it, how they're chatting about it around the coffee machine, et cetera, et cetera. And for some reason, and I think it is something particular about this event, it came kind of inchoate. It's extraordinary, it's violent, it's disturbing, it's utterly marvelous, it's incredibly hopeful, it's potentially dangerous. And the kind of maps and attempts to organize it that we experience as we try to understand what's going on don't seem particularly coherent to me. And so I've been very aware of how it is that I've been constructing my sense of this incredibly important event. And I go online, I go to mainstream news sources, CNN, watch their videos, I'll go to Al Jazeera, watch their videos, I'll talk to people. I talked to my friend Alan Bishop, and he was just completely blown away. He was totally drawn up into this revolutionary moment. Go on, hear Noam Chomsky. Look at Fox News and this whole sort of construction of the fear of the Muslim Brotherhood, the weird messages from the State Department, from President Obama. For me, it's not just about this extraordinary event, but it's about the way that the world mediates these events, and how we understand ourselves, and how we continue to think intelligently, how we continue to grapple with history, with politics, with understanding in a deeper sense, even as our media landscape is so incredibly unpredictable, confusing, overwhelming, novel. There's so much novelty in the air. So anyway, I'm very glad, however, that today's guest is the right kind of guy to have for such a moment. Matthew Battles is a wonderful writer and blogger who manages to think very hard about a lot of issues in new media and politics and the the role of changing images of natural science and how they affect how we understand the world, but also really keeping a deep recognition of where we've come from, of literate culture, of writing culture. So I'm really psyched to chat with him today. But before that, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dau. How's your media connection today, Maja?
I think it's pretty good. How do I sound?
You sound good. You sound like a lot of those people, like, reporting from Egypt. I'm curious, did you get all caught up in this revolutionary moment?
Well, yeah, Eric, I closely follow Egypt and have for a while, actually, just because I'm so into ancient Egypt. And it's so interesting, a lot of the stuff that you said, because what's happening with the way it's represented is there's this big focus on the Muslim Brotherhood. And nobody even knows, like, the history of Egypt and how it's gone through all of these regime changes. I mean, it's one of the most ancient civilizations in the world, and everyone's just putting the focus on this, like, tiny fraction of it in American media, but, like, the whole thing about even how the Muslims invaded in Alexandria in, like, 300 BC, you know, and stuff like that, and, I mean, AD, and there's no attention paid to any other, like, things that are going on in Egyptian culture or tying it to the ancient past of, like, what is feeding into this entire buildup of the revolution in Egypt. Like, it's so exciting to me because it does. It ties into literally the ancient history in Egypt, what the people are going through now. And then
it's funny, you saying that, and then I was, you know, you might go, oh, yeah, well, what does this matter then? That's the past. But that was something that came up on more than one of interviews with, you know, random dudes on the street that I saw or in the square, who talked about that, who talked about how Egypt was. It's like, he was like, but we've been doing this since the pharaohs. This is the first time in thousands of years that you've seen this thing. And it really, that scale is really important. And it's funny about the Muslim Brotherhood. It's like, it's so schizophrenic, our media. Like, I went on to Google News, you know, I was trying out all these different ways to try to figure out what was going on, because I was kind of playing with how do I understand what's going on using the media, using Twitter, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so I went on to Google News just because sometimes it's interesting to see what pops up on top of the list, and it was some, you know, silly, you know, Midwestern newspaper article about the Muslim Brotherhood, and I was like, oh, I want to see what these guys are saying. And they started out with, like, the opening two graphs were about the Muslim Brotherhood, da 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 da, and then they finally went, but actually the Muslim Brotherhood isn't really that important right now. And the rest of the article is about how people are saying, like, yeah, they're part of it, but, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on too, and it's not, you know, they're just a little bit better organized than everybody. So they have this, like, juicy fear-mongering header, but that actually wasn't what the article was about. So it's a very schizophrenic moment. But anyway, I've been gabbing here a little bit longer than I usually do, and I want to bring on Matthew Battles. Matthew, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, you bet. It's great to be on.
Excellent. So I mean, I you know, I want to talk to you about you know, your the stuff you do, the things you're thinking about, the topics that obsess you. But I'm curious, since you are such a rich media watcher and you think deeply about things, how have you kind of experienced just sort of the mediation of the extraordinary event and how you've experienced it over this last week plus?
Yeah, right on. You know, what both of you have said, you know, rings true and resonates with my own experience. I feel like in these moments, we're beset by these kind of schizophrenic images, these kind of uncanny, haunted images of what's happening somewhere else in the world that are, you know, the filters sort of strip all of that context, that ancient history, much less the, you know, whatever kind of stuff is going down socioeconomically and politically in this place, and impose, you know, it's like extruding these images through these filters from the 20th century that don't really quite work for the moment. I mean, we keep looking for ideology in these moments. We keep looking for, like, a plan, like a manifesto. You know, it reminds me of how sort of strange and you know, unreadable the motivations of the early resistors to the American invasion of Iraq were. What did they want? What did they, you know, what were they so upset about? We saw all these wonderful scenes of statues of Saddam Hussein being pulled down in public squares, and now suddenly everybody's angry at us. We're just trying to do something something good. And, you know, it seems like we're trying to apply all of these filters that just aren't adequate to the circumstances.
Yeah, but for me, and maybe it just reflects my own experience or my own sort of chaotic media consumption habits. But it's like the fractures of that process are very visible.
Mm-hmm.
The attempt mm-hmm. to create a story or to lay on a map, to lay on these sort of more, whether they have to do with the representational government or a certain
right.
notion of like
right.
ideologically motivated political parties from the, you know, 19th or 20th centuries in terms of radicalism. And yet there's just behind all that or kind of shining through it is this event, because revolutionary moments, whatever else they may be, are these extraordinary kinds of events that are larger, richer, more multidimensional than any mm-hmm. pattern you can put on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. And you do see that flame, that core of energy in the midst of all of this. And it's utterly fascinating. And, you know, one of the things that this media sphere we're engaged with gives us the opportunity to do is just train on that like moths to a flame. I mean, the compulsion to just follow the feeds is such a powerful one, and the sense of being involved somehow, and not sure what the extent of your involvement is, and unsure of what the effects of that involvement will be ultimately, but nonetheless compelled to witness, to engage, to share. These are very basic impulses that these media give us the opportunity to engage, whether the levers that we use to engage those experiences are hooked up in the way we think they are is another question altogether.
No, but let's stay on this a little bit, because it's a really interesting point, that mm-hmm. sense of participating. And I think that it's deeper than just the fact that our media are more interactive, that we feel closer
yes.
to, you know, I can find some Egyptian blogger that I like, and I can get on his Twitter feed and then
mm-hmm.
see updates. So obviously I feel more connected than if I'm just sitting back and reading a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
But there seems to be something deeper than that in terms of we're part of the process by which this new or this emerging transforming mediascape actually understands itself, like understands what are events, how do events make a difference, you know,
right.
and like you say, we don't really know where the levers are,
mm-hmm.
but we are, you know, kind of part of this this sort of experimental way of engaging, you know, what is happening, where is what is happening? Is it just happening in Egypt? No, it's an event that's also happening in the global information matrix. And if the events are intense enough, WikiLeaks is a different example, but interesting because
yeah.
it also revealed something that was going on underneath the surface. We have
right.
this moment to catch something, you know, kind of pretty trippy as well
yeah.
as pretty
yeah.
politically novel.
Yeah, for real. You know, it's... It's as if a major sort of, you know, heavily brocaded curtain of narrative, in a sense, has sort of fallen or is disarranged in some fundamental way now. To the extent that so many of these experiences in the past, we waited for the narratives to be crafted. We needed to wait for a story to be told, to come to grips with them. And now we're in the midst of, as you say, this kind of eruptive, disruptive dynamo of story making that's happening in what seems like real time. Now, at the same time, of course, the distances are still distances, and we've by the same token, we've always been immediately engaged in the world. The flavor of that engagement seems to be changing in some way. I'm not sure where, you know, to what extent scales are being removed from our eyes, or we're finding new kinds of scales to wear. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, that's always the question.
Because I mean, and I think if you look at it in terms of, like Eric said, with information technology and how much we're seeing, I mean, there's a little bit of an echo with like the Vietnam War with what's going on because of that instantaneous coverage that was happening. And like what happened in the beginning in Egypt, how they were covering it in their own media, and it was very media fueled in Egypt. And then they had like the kill switch on the internet. that happened that went through, you know, and it very much is like that participation in the Vietnam War that we went through when people could see it happening in their living room. So it was like how much they could see affected their participation in it. So literally, like you said, like having those things in front of our visibility and that curtain kind of rent aside in this situation is what is really making it very revolutionary in that sense.
I thought of another aspect of it where it feels like we're part of this kind of global process of trying to understand how to grapple with such significant events is there's almost it's almost like you can feel the sort of dialectic of history in action. And the way that I really felt that in this case was, you know, over the last few years when there've been mass movement riots, the demonstrations in Tehran last year were a great example. There's a great deal of emphasis in the media about the role that Twitter and cell phones and chat plays in sort of organizing people. And I think some of us who are very invested in certain kind of political ideals who are also like online nerds, you know, you get very excited about it. And there's this kind of idea of like, this is the technology we love in action. And then what we have here is this clear evidence that people are perfectly capable of doing their disorganized organization without those things.
We've gotten
to another level where even the attempt for the government to shut these things down because of these associations with political organization, nonetheless, we still see this extraordinary uprising.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of amazingly empowering and revivifying to see it in that perspective, because, you know, you realize that we've been networking for a really long time as human beings, you know, and these tools extend our capacity to do that in some ways. They complicate it in some ways, even as they simplify other aspects of it. But we've got these basic, you know, onboard systems for imagining consensually and collaboratively and envisioning ends and working towards them together. And, you know, the networked, the technological instantiations of those are you know, an elaboration of something that's really durable and core to what it is that makes us the creatures we are.
Well, okay, then let's go to some other issues that you're dealing with. I mean, you write a lot about technology. You keep your finger on the pulse, particularly of how media is affecting writing, literature, affecting how we, you know, kind of communicate in terms of providing information to one another. I'm curious, with all the time you've spent on it, do you tend to see it more in terms of rupture, or do you tend to see it more in terms of continuity? That we're basically doing what we've been doing, it's just that it's changing and intensifying? Or do you see that this, wherever you want to start it, sometime in modernity, sometime with electronic media, with digital media, that there's real kinds of ruptures that are creating fundamentally new or unpredictable situations?
Yeah, it's sort of at the central question of the stuff that fascinates me, and I feel like my impulsive answer is a kind of weaselly one, which is to say something like, rupture is our nature, you know, that we find our continuity in these eruptive transformations, particularly in eruptive transformations in the way in which, you know, we tell stories, we convey information, we remember the past and share that experience with our fellow creatures. But I do, I guess, you know, my sensibility is sort of tuned towards continuity insofar as I can't help but be fascinated by how what seems so so new and so disruptive in our present moment, rhymes with or resonates with things that have happened in the past. And so when I look at, you know, when people are frustrated with, what seems to be from their perspective to be a sort of decay of you know, intellectual authority and standards in a phenomenon like Wikipedia, I like to think about how, well, you know, very similar concerns were voiced when the first encyclopedia was being written, or the first notable encyclopedia, Denise Diderot's encyclopedia of the late 18th century. People worried then about crumbling canons of authority. People worried then about the decentralization of intellectual authority and legitimacy. And that time of Enlightenment literature was so fueled by the power of the printing press, and along with the works of philosophers and literateurs that remain important to us now, like Voltaire, like Rousseau, there were all of these kind of crazy, salacious, erotic, libelous books and pamphlets being published at the same time, you know, that look a lot like 4chan does today. And so in order for that cream to sort of rise to the top that we take for granted now as the fruits of Enlightenment culture, all of this other stuff had to happen at the same time. And I see so much of what's going on in our media sphere today as elaborating and providing the opportunity for that stuff to crackle and fizz as it's wont to do.
Well, one of the things I really like about your approach that's really meant a lot to me, you know, I just want to mention that you have been writing very regularly for Gear Fuse for quite a while now and writing about a lot of this kind of material.
Yeah.
Other places as well, though I guess people can check your stuff out. But one of the things I really like about your stuff is that I find in myself a tendency, maybe it's getting older, maybe I'm just a crank, I don't know what it is, that there's this, I get these waves of crankiness where my earlier, you know, considered enthusiasm, I was never a techno-utopian by any stretch of the imagination,
right,
but my considered enthusiasm for new media, for digital media, for the internet, you know, starts to wane precipitously, and I find a certain kind of crankiness arising. I don't really trust that much either. I start to see, like, oh, you know, the quality of writing is decaying, the quality of thinking is decaying, the way people interact with each other is decaying, the art of conversation is dying, blah, blah, blah. And I see myself going into this kind of cranky conservative space.
Right.
And one of the things I really love about your writing more than most people that I know who cover these kinds of topics is that I can tell that you understand those feelings and those interpretations, and yet you've gone through them in a way to kind of, you know, not be too sentimental and fall into sort of some easy emotional traps that people have when faced with change, and
right,
instead try to really get a sense of, like, look, this isn't, you know, techno-utopia, but it's a lot richer and more multivalent than that kind of pessimism would lead to. Am I right in that? I mean, how do you feel about that? That kind of temptation to a certain kind of pessimism where you bemoan
the great
things of the past, et cetera.
Yeah, I get exactly where you're coming from. And I feel those stirrings all the time. I mean, you know, before I was blogging regularly and doing a lot of writing on the internet, I worked for 8 years in a rare books library at Harvard. And, you know, I was in daily contact with these, you know, cultural objects reaching back 500 years, 1,000 years, and you know, it's cultural objects which are rare, which are ephemeral, which are fragile, you know, and so it's very, you know, the recourse to a kind of sentimentality or nostalgia is really a powerful attraction there when you're in the midst of that kind of cultural richness. At the same time, those things were reminding me constantly of how people have been fumbling all along to figure out how these things work, to figure out how to use them to connect with each other, to figure out how to bring their inchoate experience of living in this universe into a form that they can share with other people. And so I feel like that kind of pushes me through a veil of nostalgia or fear about where these things are changing. We've faced these shocks, these transformations, you know, as a species, as cultures, many times in the past, and you know, I think the stuff that really puts us in peril is at another order of existence. You know, we're not imperiled existentially by Wikipedia, right? As long as we keep trying to connect, I think there's hope for some kind of human spark to maintain.
Yeah, no, very much. I can see that. Well, I want to get into some more examples of some of the places you see interesting things happening online. But I think we'll take a break here before I do. This is Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and we're talking with Matthew Battles, and we'll be right back.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello. Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
Hi, this is Adam Kolker from the Brooklyn Jazz Underground. We're going to be hosting a weekly show every Tuesday at 5 p.m., focusing on sounds coming from the borough of Brooklyn. We'll be playing some new releases, doing live interviews, some live performances, maybe even venture out into music from some of the outer boroughs. Brooklyn Jazz Underground, Tuesday at 5, only on the Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down, or you're just curious, be sure to listen in, Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. For material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network, Fridays at 3 p.m.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Masha Bahu, and we're here with Eric Davis, interviewing Matthew Battles about all kinds of great stuff. Matthew, you said something before the break that I found very interesting, just because I'm a librarian at a rare books library also. And, great. You know, I noticed your book that you had done, The Library, An Unquiet History, it's very fascinating to me, just because libraries really are that kind of cultural connection. And even when I worked at the public library, you would see where people could come in with any kind of thing and see who had experienced it before. Like, whether it's like, I have cancer, let me find books on who has gone through this, to like, I need to fix my plumbing, who has done this before. But it literally is about these cultural places and networks people can go to go through what people have done before. And even if that's about getting access to a book by Voltaire or by seeing what it was that Socrates wrote about a certain condition or seeing Herodotus's version of this happening over and over again. And I think, like, Egypt certainly is a great example of that, that we've been here before, and just the importance of recirculating that knowledge throughout ourselves through these cultural disciplines and things like that. And I was wondering, can you think of like a good example in, like, for example, when you were at the Rare Books place, did you have like a particular question that really kind of lit up your head about that kind of connection where you actually saw it happening in the library in front of you?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think a couple of things come to mind. First of all, when I started to work in the library, I spent 6 years at Harvard as the editor of an academic journal that was published in the library. But before that, I worked for a couple of years in Widener Library at Harvard as essentially a librarian. Widener's the big research library, the kind of general library at Harvard, a couple of million books in the stacks, and my job was kind of a dubious one. I was supposed to go through the stacks looking for books that could be sent away from the library because the library was about to undergo a big renovation, and
right.
And we needed to make room. We needed to get 500,000 books out of the stacks in about a year. But it gave me this incredible opportunity to basically live in the stacks for a year, just kind of going from area to area looking for books that hadn't been used much, or looking for books that were duplicates, and working with faculty to find books that could safely be taken and put somewhere else where it might take a little longer to get to them. So however you feel about that sort of thing, I was sort of immersed in this enormous library stack day in and day out, and struck by how much it was like a gigantic book itself. Mm. It was like this book that all of these people, generations of, you know, librarians, faculty, students had collaboratively authored together, you know, collaboratively and somewhat anonymously, quasi-anonymously, but they had left their traces, you know, they'd left traces in how used the books were. I mean, it's just kind of the uncanny kind of experiences kept cropping up of time, dislocation in time, where you take a book off the shelf that had been published in 1898 and it had never been opened. You know, the pages were still uncut, as they used to make books with the pages folded but not yet cut, so you would have to slice them open to read the book.
Right.
So the pages hadn't been cut, the spine had never been opened, so it cracked the first time you opened it. It was like picking up a new book in 1898, where, by contrast, you know, a book that was maybe published 20 years ago had been used and used and used, so that the pages were rubbed and worn, and you know, oils from people's skin had soaked into the pages, and the pages were falling out, and the corners were chipped, and that book in a way seems older than the new book that was published and printed 100 years before. So, you know, being in a library is this sense of, you know, this sense that pervades the place of common endeavor, of kind of collaborative, collective, you know, imaginal experience and action. And at the same time, as you begin to delve into the history of libraries, you realize that, you know, this stuff doesn't just happen. I mean, libraries have a history, and, you know, the libraries that we take for granted today, or seem at risk of losing today in some inchoate way, were hard won in history. People had to want that kind of experience.
Ironic, because really, like, the biggest example of that happened in Egypt, right, with the Library of Alexandria. I mean, that was one of the best examples of
Absolutely.
What you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the best examples, of course, primarily for the fact that it disappeared almost without a trace. I mean, we don't know exactly where the library was in Alexandria now. No books from that library actually exist. There are, of course, copies of books that were in that library that exist to this day. Copies also of catalogs that were made by the librarians at the time. This place that was the center of intellectual and spiritual life in the Mediterranean for hundreds of years you know, vanished. I mean, it's an Ozymandias moment of extraordinary power. And yet it didn't vanish insofar as we, you know, we carry it in our hearts and in our minds and in our stories. And this keeps happening again and again and again. These hard-won collective experiences of books, of stories, of wisdom, that sort of emerge and break like bubbles, you know, on the surface of history, and reform somewhere else in some other slightly different set of colors and flavors. Well, that play is a fascinating one to me.
Yeah, well, let's take this, you know, into today and tomorrow, in the sense of how, rather than ask you, you know, you can ask a general question, oh, the death of the library, how things are changing online, et cetera, but I'm more interested in how do you, what is your practice, intellectual, as a writer, as a researcher, that keeps that alive, in the sense of that this is a set of values, a way of looking at the world, a way of understanding texts and libraries, and you bring that sensibility into your interaction with the internet and blogging and tracking the kind of emerging technoculture. So how do you bring that forward? How do you sort of put forward that renewed hope and faith in that spark and in that collective activity?
Yeah, well, I think it probably would be characterized as a kind of hectic dialectic, insofar as I keep charting this zigzag course back and forth between what seem like polar opposites. At the time that I was writing the book about libraries, Library and Unquiet History, I was immersed in libraries, and in some ways I missed that time of my life, palpably. I mean, I have a lot of nostalgia about my experience of those libraries. And at that time, my working patterns were, I mean, I used, you know, we're talking like, you know, 2000, 2001 when I started to work on that book. And I used the Internet. The Internet was an important part of my life, but not to nearly the extent it has become so in the 10 years since. Most of my day was spent wandering around looking for books and putting books together and seeing what kind of stories they would tell to me and to each other. And now I don't work in the library anymore, and in some ways it feels like some kind of Eden, you know, and this kind of sword of fire stands between me and that experience. I feel like it's like gone and I can't recapture it. But on the other hand, I've got this extraordinary, you know, palpable, tactile, noosphere of the internet, where, you know, at the same time, a lot of wonderful things are happening every day, and one of the most amazing things about the internet to me is the way these kind of collectives of very kind of tenuously gathered souls, you know, people who really offer marvelous kind of flavors, intellectual, creative, spiritual flavors, manage to attract themselves to one another and find ways to make things happen. To make things happen with a kind of spontaneity and spirit that was hard to capture before this internet thing came along. At the same time, I feel like the very fluid and dynamic and ephemeral nature of that kind of collaboration leaves me sometimes wanting a kind of quiet, a kind of solitude, a kind of St. Jerome-like sequestering away in some kind of cabinet somewhere that seems not possible to affect anymore. Of course, it's entirely possible. You know, I can just shut the machines off and close the door. But somehow it's more complicated than that.
So we're talking a little bit about you, before, about this sort of uncanny chatter that books can have in libraries. I think anybody who's a bibliophile knows the magic of stumbling across just the right book at the right time, or opening a book to any page, and you do get that sense of the way, as you said, that the library is like one big book. But I also know that you're sensitive to those kind of uncanny moments in a kind of more, you know, futuristic or contemporary media technology framework. And talk a little little bit about that. You've written some short stories about the technological uncanny, a topic that I find extremely fascinating. What were your own experiences or your own interests that led you to kind of tune into that peculiar wavelength?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's probably an experience more common than we may realize, that we have these kind of turnabout moments in using the media, where suddenly you're confronted with how bizarre these technologies really are, that these disembodied voices come at our beck and call, and yet they're beyond our control and are only fitfully under our control. I think that sense that the gadgets that we use are haunted in some ways is probably really an ancient feeling, right? There were household gods in ancient Rome, and the sense that, you know, that not only the natural world but the built environment is embodied by ghosts, spirits, geniuses, diamonds of one kind or another. I think that you know, those eruptions are, and I'm sure this is more or less sympathetic with where you're coming from, Eric, that these are things that, there are connections that we spark all the time. And there's a way in which we kind of want to paper that over, I think, in a technological culture, in a scientific culture. And our science works assiduously to paper that over. And yet I think at the same time our technology, our gadgets, are constantly trying to excavate that stuff. Something I wrote about on GearFuse a couple of weeks ago strikes me as interesting in this vein. There was at the Consumer Electronics Show, CES, in Las Vegas, there was among thousands of products that were demoed, there was this product that was billed as a light bulb / projector, and it was like a concept gadget. It wasn't built to be commoditized, but this company that builds control systems, microcircuits for controlling all kinds of hardware in the world, they had built this light bulb that they put a Pico projector into, so that you could project a PowerPoint display from a light bulb. Now, it didn't look like a light bulb that you just put in a desk lamp. It was more like a theatrical light bulb. It was this big sort of glowing brain, you know. It looked like a brain out of some kind of, 1920s science fiction film. And I was struck by how desperately we want to, embody these gadgets, something as simple as a light bulb, which is, of course, also always a metaphor for genius, for inspiration, for the spark of serendipity or invention. We somehow want to bring that humble gadget to life, to give it a brain, Now, a lot of gadget blogs they'll focus on the size of the projector that was put into this light bulb, or the fact that it runs on the Android operating system, and talk about the specifications of the device. But I was really interested in how this device seemed like a engineered to be haunted.
Well, that's really weird that you say that, because it sounds exactly like a magic lantern. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with a magic lantern, but that's literally where film comes from, and it was called, that's where we get the term phantasmagoria, and they used it to project spirits. So the idea that that's haunted, because it's a recapitulation of the magic lantern, where they would literally project spirits onto the wall and people would think it was ghosts. I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah. Isn't it? And the thing that really fascinated me about it is how all of that stuff about lamps is just right below the surface, to the extent that, people would go to CES and see this thing and they would think, like, intuitively, oh, of course, a lamp that is a projector, without really, without having the historical perspective to reflect on why that might be so intuitively charismatic to them, when in fact, a desk lamp that's also a projector, in terms of a gadget or a piece of hardware, doesn't work all that well, because there's this big light on in the room now. We're trying to see what it's projecting on the wall, and it's kind of like this deranged expression of all of that stuff that's buried in our historical consciousness.
Yeah, it's funny. Maybe this is a bit of a stretch, but there's a connection here between this sensitivity to the technological uncanny and to the way that it reveals sort of kind of hidden histories, or at least those histories of technology and of human desire and of media that relate with the less rational parts of ourselves. But there's a relationship between that and those moments in particular when you first see them, when you have that kind of sense of that other world leaking through for just a moment. And there's a relationship between that and these more significant political events that we started off talking about, is that, yeah, I think that in the case of an extraordinary uprising like we're seeing in Egypt, or for example the WikiLeaks event was another one, is that even though these are very political, real world, economic bodies, violence, politics, etc., there's also a way in which as they get refracted through the media in particular, there is this kind of uncanniness opened up, this kind of sense of like, where is it? Where is the event actually kind of occurring, or how is it reverberating? And that part of our attraction to it is precisely the way that these events point us to something that is beyond or transcends the usual political, rational, institutional way of organizing reality. There's like a crack, and in that crack we can start to glimpse, maybe through a veil, maybe as you say, where it's never really clear whether we're getting a vantage point or just getting new scales, but we can glimpse a kind of order of power, or a way that the world is organized, or the way that reality is mediated now, that actually tells us in many ways as much, if not more, than all the specs, than all the institutional logics, than the political analysis necessarily.
Right.
So I think there's a politics of these moments as well, of these technological uncannies. They're not just about gadgets or entertainment or odd little bits. They tell us something about power and the
image. They really do, don't they? Yeah, it reminds me of what you just said. Reminds me of, if you go trolling for, sort of paranoid expressions of or examinations of the possibility of alien invasion on YouTube. You find all of these people who are uploading clips they've taken from cable news shows of glitches, moments of glitch, technological glitch, where somebody's skin, because of the way the video feed is tuned to soften skin tones and sharpen the lines of an anchorman suit, sometimes you'll get the skin tone will start to go kind of reptilian. And it's a technological glitch, but a lot of people have uploaded these clips as evidence of these guys are Daleks or some kind of alien invaders, at occasional moments the technology reveals their true kind of V nature, that they're really some kind of reptilian overlords from elsewhere. And I think, that's where at those kind of moments of sort of techno apophenia, when we're kind of sort of skimming right across the top of some kind of glitchy, fizzy experience of technology, where for some of us that's just like you're supposed to look past that, right? You're supposed to that's a mistake. But for others that's like the key to what's really going on. And for some of us those moments are kind of moments where we see our own propensities to tune into these deeper stirrings revealed.
You can almost apply that to a more ancient kind of technology, right? I mean, it's like the same as a mirror.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When technological devices reveal those kind of things about us in these like accidental moments, I mean, it's serving the same purpose as like, Narcissus staring into the pool, or whenever anyone would see themselves in a mirror, it's like using a technology to reveal something like beneath the surface. So that's
right.
Even been happening since ancient times.
Yeah. One of my favorite technologies right now is the Humble animated GIF. I've just had a sort of resurgence of fascination with the animated GIF, which is such a kind of tawdry piece of visual technology in a way. I mean, gets back to the origins of kind of dodgy web visuals, but in some instances, I think an animated GIF can be so revealing. There's this there's this Tumblr of animated GIFs from films called called If We Don't Remember Me, where this, the person who does this Tumblr, I don't know who it is, they take, you know, they basically do like very subtly animated stills from motion pictures like A Clockwork Orange, Apocalypse Now, where you get this moment from, you know, an iconic image like Martin Sheen, you know, covered in swamp juice, confronting Kurtz. But in this animated GIF, he's just very subtly breathing, and it's something you don't even notice at first, you know, or a scene from Belle de Jour, where the main character is staring off into space, and she's staring off into space for like 10 seconds, and then suddenly she looks at you, and I feel like that's, you know, this is a very kind of mannered and figured way of using a very humble technology to get at something that happens to us all the time when we're looking at these, at, you know, unavoidably glitchy and buzzy and staticky images that we're feeding ourselves constantly.
Yeah, it's like seeing you know, kind of patterns and noise that moment, and it's a funny one too, because you know, getting back a little bit towards the glitch, is that the way that the glitch has become its own kind of, you know, figure. Like here, I'm thinking about, you know, a period of you know, electronic music where the glitch became an aesthetic move, where people would sample the sounds of CDs skipping, and then they would bring that skip into the sound, or they would put on Crackle or whatever, and there's a sense that there's a kind of another dimension there, which could just be aesthetic. It's a new flavor. We learn to celebrate the crappy bit rates and the low res, you know, YouTube videos, and it sort of almost enjoy that. But I think there's also a sense that it's always in the noise or the crack or the unexpected that we grow in on some sense, especially when a lot of the time we feel so kind of constrained by technologies, or the sense that they're overwhelmingly the codes are everywhere, that there's something really beautiful about the ability to still make that gesture or to discover it, you know, emerging almost like a nature returned in the guise of a broken signal or a cross wires or a glitch on the cell phone.
It reminds me of something I remember hearing when I was a kid, seeing on a PBS documentary about Parkinson's disease, and I don't even know if the science is still correct on this, but I remember being arrested when I was when I was a teenager by this notion that, you know, the brain waves, sort of normal healthy brain waves are kind of disordered, are kind of staticky, because there are so many different signals being processed by the brain at the same time. Where somebody who's afflicted with Parkinson's, they fall into resonance, they fall into rhythm, they become more ordered, and that generates the palsy of Parkinson's, and that sense that there's some kind of underlying, that we create a kind of, maybe to a certain extent, culture as a way of creating a certain amount of noise to keep us sane, to keep us doing what we're supposed to be doing. But then there's this primordial, not disorder, but this primordial order that's actually capable of deranging us.
In a way, that's what the democratic action is. In a way, that's what all those people on the street are doing. They're each one is making their own quote unquote individual decision, but overall, it's this enormous explosion of noise, and people are projecting patterns onto the noise. Oh, it's the Muslim Brotherhood. Yeah. Oh, it's because of globalization. Oh, because it's the young people are plugged into technology. But in a way, you know, it's a very un-narrativized experience. I mean, there's parts of it that go into violence or mob violence. A little something happens, and then all of these emotions happen. But right next door to it is a very different kind of, you know, deeply a thoughtful kind of existential, even spiritual gesture in the face of power. And it's all going on at the same time.
And it's funny because actually in science, when you look at absolute order, that's thermodynamic equilibrium, which is death, basically.
Yeah, right. Heat, death, yeah.
Yeah.
the absence of entropy, right?
Exactly.
And that evocation of the political dimension of it is so powerful. And the way in which we've kind of peeled back a veil, you know, this veil of kind of public opinion where you know, before everything kind of was getting slotted into, you know, into preconceived categories and narratives, right? And this disorder and simultaneity of actual lived existence is one of the great, I think, sources of epiphany of our time. And you know, the thing about those sources of epiphany is you're never quite sure how they're going to play out. You know, how are we going to use that? How are we going to use that awareness that we have, this glimpse that we have for now, which the door may get shut on it very soon. You know, so what do we do with that window while it's open? I think that's the kind of political question, you know, that we primarily are experiencing these things in this heavily mediated way need to ask ourselves.
That's a wonderful question. I think I'm going to leave it there, and I just want to make enough room to tell people that about places to check your stuff out. I didn't mention that Matthew is the co-founder of High Lowbrow, which is a wonderful website, web magazine, web whatever you want to call it, that I've written for a few times. And in addition to checking it out at High Lowbrow, H-I-L-O, brow.com, you can go to his own MB Tales, Matthew Battle Tales. So check it out there and check out Gearfuse. Hey, Matthew, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, you bet. It was a lot of fun. It was great fun talking.
All right. Keep your minds open.